Hello there and welcome. Today is Wednesday, July 26th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump bashes his attorney general again on Twitter.
If he was going to recuse himself, he should have told me prior to taking office, and I would have quite simply picked somebody else.
Republicans are continuing their efforts to repeal President Obama's health care law. Tensions remain high between Israel and the Palestinians. Also ahead, how Prince Harry and Prince William are remembering their mother, Princess Diana. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, an angry President Trump is keeping up his Twitter offensive against perceived enemies, including a fierce attack against his own Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, which has prompted condemnation from even Republican leaders and usually loyal conservative media outlets.
I want the Attorney General to be much tougher on the leaks from intelligence agencies, which are leaking like rarely have they ever leaked before at a very important level. These are intelligence agencies. We cannot have that happen. You know many of my views in addition to that, but I think that's one of the very important things that they have to get on with. I told you before, I'm very disappointed with the Attorney General, but we will see what happens.
Well, Trump has said he's angry that Sessions recused himself from the Russian election meddling investigation. And if Sessions were to leave, he'd have a better chance of firing Special Counsel Robert Mueller, who's heading the investigation. Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer warned the president not to try that.
Many Americans must be wondering if the president is trying to pry open the office of Attorney General to appoint someone during the August recess who will fire Special Counsel Mueller and shut down the Russian investigation. First, let me state for the record now, before this scheme gains wings, Democrats will never go along with the recess appointment if that situation arises.
Well, joining me now for more on this complex story is attorney and political commentator James Goodnow. Thanks for being with us, James. What's your take on what's happening here?
Well, I think when you look at this, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out what's happening. This isn't about recusal. This isn't about Hillary Clinton's emails, which we heard in the latest tweet coming earlier today. This is about Russia. This is about Bob Mueller and his investigation. And Donald Trump believes that perhaps his best path to killing that investigation would be to get rid of Jeff Sessions. At least that's what many pundits are saying. It seems to make sense. And here's why. If Donald Trump fires Jeff Sessions, or if Jeff Sessions resigns, Donald Trump will have the power to appoint another attorney general. And if that happens during a congressional recess, that person would go assume the position immediately. If Donald Trump is smart about this and pick someone who's disconnected from his campaign and disconnected from Russia, that new attorney general would not have to recuse himself or herself. Then that attorney general would functionally be the boss of Bob Mueller and would have the power to either constrict the investigation through funds or to fire Bob Mueller altogether. Now, I would imagine that Donald Trump and his advisors are saying, well, that's a long shot. That's probably not going to happen. But there is a possibility that with Sessions gone, that could be the end game here. So I believe that really is what's going on in Donald Trump's head, it seems to be. And he certainly has said that. In speaking of recusal, that relates to Russia. So I think this is a concerning situation. I think we've seen near universal condemnation of this move coming from Democrats and Republicans. They're concerned about this. Jeff Sessions is a fixture of the Republican Party. He appeals to Donald Trump's base. So I do think this is a politically dangerous move for Donald Trump.
And it's interesting, too, because Jeff Sessions was fiercely loyal to Donald Trump during the campaign. He was, I believe, the first senator to come out in support, throw his support behind the candidate Trump. And I know Donald Trump really values loyalty. So it would seem maybe he thinks this isn't being loyal. But is the job of an attorney general to be loyal to the president or to the law of the country?
It's the latter. And this is really Donald Trump's problem. He needs to go back to a junior high civics class here. There is a separation of powers that exists between the White House and the Justice Department. The Justice Department needs to function as an independent agency because of exactly the situation we're in right now. There are scenarios where you could have the Justice Department investigating the White House. So you can't have control being exercised over it. And Donald Trump just doesn't seem to get that. He wants Jeff Sessions to have his back. He wants the Justice Department to be looking out for him. But that's not the way the law works, and that's not the way our country works. So that certainly is a fundamental issue that continues to lead to all of these problems and, frankly, the firings that we've seen going from Sally Yates to Jim Comey, and now it looks like Jeff Sessions.
If the president wants this thing to end and he has nothing to hide, why not just let it finish, let it go? He'll be exonerated if he has nothing to hide.
That's certainly the question that everyone has. And even Republican strategists encourage the president to get the information out to the public. The problem is that hasn't happened. And we know that even in situations where it may be benign, when you see a failure to disclose, when you see attempts to hide meetings over and over and over again, it creates certainly a suspicion. And it causes people to question, why is this happening? And when you see a president that's refusing to acknowledge that Russia meddled in our elections, it causes people to say, how could this be? And we're really going to see the president tested here, as we have a sanctions bill that's coming up to him. It seems to have bipartisan support and will end up in the Oval Office for signature. And whether or not Donald Trump is going to sign that or veto it, right now we've heard some mixed signals coming from the White House on this, but I think this will be a test. And if Donald Trump doesn't sign that sanctions bill, I think it will be yet another paper cut. Of course, paper cuts don't kill you. Mm-hmm. And the question is, will there be enough of them where Republicans will start to turn against Trump? And right now, they're not going to, because they need Trump to pass their agenda. They need Trump for health care reform. They need Trump for tax reform. And unless it appears that all of those efforts are going to fail, I don't suspect that you're going to see Republicans that are going to be quick to turn against him, at least to the extent that would it lead down the road of potential impeachment.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective. Attorney and political commentator James Goodnow. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. The U.S. warship fires warning shots at an Iranian military vessel. President Trump pledges U.S. aid to help Lebanon against Islamic State. The State Department denies rumors that Rex Tillerson could be considering resigning. And a new yoga trend includes traditional poses and baby goats. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, days after a brain cancer diagnosis, Republican Senator John McCain returned to Capitol Hill Tuesday, just in time to cast a decisive vote to begin debate on repealing former President Obama's health care law. McCain chided his colleagues for the lack of progress they've made in deciding what to do about the Affordable Care Act.
We've been spinning our wheels on too many important issues because we keep trying to find a way to win without help from across the aisle. That's an approach that's been employed by both sides, mandating legislation from the top down without any support from the other side, with all the parliamentary maneuvers that requires. We're getting nothing done, my friends. We're getting nothing done.
McCain received a rousing ovation from his colleagues when he strode into the Senate floor, and they broke into applause to cheer the sometimes stern message he delivered.
We've tried to do this by coming up with a proposal behind closed doors in consultation with the administration, then springing it on skeptical members, trying to convince them that it's better than nothing. That it's better than nothing? Asking us to swallow our doubts and force it past a unified opposition. I don't think that's going to work in the end, and probably shouldn't. The administration and congressional Democrats shouldn't have forced through Congress without any opposition support of social and economic change as massive as Obamacare. And we shouldn't do the same with ours.
Well, even with McCain's vote, the chamber was deadlocked 50-50. Vice President Mike Pence cast a tie-breaking vote to begin the debate, which is still going on this evening. He called on all senators to govern better by embracing compromise, bipartisanship, and the Senate's traditional way of doing business. In a series of tweets early Tuesday, President Trump said Obamacare is, quote, torturing Americans. A recent public opinion survey, however, show that Americans view the existing Affordable Care Act much more favorably than any of the Republicans' proposals to repeal it. Thousands of Palestinian Muslims prayed in the streets near Jerusalem's mostly contested holy site on Tuesday, heeding a call by clergy to not enter the shrine despite Israel's seeming capitulation when it removed metal detectors it installed there a week earlier. State Department spokeswoman Heather Nauert was asked by reporters whether it was a good idea for Israel to remove the metal detectors from the holy site.
Anything that serves to de-escalate tensions, okay, and pave the road for the two sides to come together and have conversations not only about this, but also about the peace process moving forward, we would certainly support that. As you know, we support the maintenance of the status quo at that site.
Muslim leaders said that they would only call off the protests once they made sure Israel had restored the situation to what it was before the crisis. Some Muslim officials, though, alleged that Israel used the absence of Muslim clerics from the walled compound in the past week of protests to install new security cameras. VOA's Victor Beatty asks American University professor emeritus for the Center for Israeli Studies, Russell Stone, if the move from Israel was a concession.
The removing of the metal detectors is clearly a concession. The many Israeli journalists were saying that, in fact, Israel's position is weakened by having taken a stand which was initially unreasonable and then being basically forced to back down.
Well, of course, Israel was subjected to an attack, two policemen killed on July 14th. Didn't Israel have some justification for doing what it did?
Yes, of course they did. And the justification is a convenient reason if the government was looking for one. Apparently, the arms had been secreted in the holy compound and then were taken, supplied to the gunmen from there. And the necessity of trying to detect that kind of thing is clearly an imperative for Israel. But the measures that they took would not have prevented something like that from happening, because who knows how long those arms had actually been there.
Well, the Muslim worshippers apparently are not modified by this. The Waqf, the religious body running the Islamic sites, including the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, said worshippers will continue to stay away from elevated marble and stone plaza, Islam's third holiest shrine, and pray in the streets outside.
Well, they've found that this is a popular and very newsworthy approach, so they will continue it. There's nothing stopping them from doing so. Israel is going ahead with ordering and installing high-tech surveillance equipment that will probably take up to 6 months to be in place. But the point is, it's not the installation, but the publicity surrounding it that creates additional kind of ammunition for the Muslim leaders. Israel should just go ahead and do it and keep quiet about it.
We also have the situation at the Israeli embassy in Amman, where two Jordanians killed after one apparently lunged with a screwdriver at a security guard. Israel seems to be in a tough spot here as well.
Well, since that time, the person who was injured and some of the embassy staff from Jordan have been permitted to return to Israel. It's a very short trip. Now, there's no indication that there was a quid pro quo, that allowing them to return was conditioned on agreeing to remove the detection devices. But the two are clearly associated in the minds of many observers.
Well, this both situations appear to be no-win, catch-22 type situations for Israel.
Yes, what they do is highlight again the fact that officially Jordan is the protector of the Muslim holy sites on inside Jerusalem. This is an agreement that dates back to before 1967, Jerusalem was captured by Israel, and when it was controlled by Jordan. The religious leadership, the Mufti and religious leaders, are essentially responsible to the Jordanian government in terms of official administrative control of the area.
Are you concerned about a possible third intifada over this situation?
It could indeed happen. There are some that are agitating toward it. There have been growing tensions just in general over the situation. It's very difficult to predict whether this kind of thing will escalate into another massive uprising.
But the PR seems to be on the side of the Muslim worshippers at this point. Is that your view?
Right now it is, yes. And the best Israel can do is to cool it, to stop publicizing the surveillance devices, to let it pass, to permit the worshippers to move into the Temple Mount area, the holy compound area, if they choose to do so. This means that if they choose not to do so, they will be seen as the instigators.
That was VOA's Victor Beatty talking to American University professor emeritus for the Center for Israeli Studies, Russell Stone. And turning now to what's trending on social media, we're joined by Andrew Palchewski. Hey, Andrew, what's going on?
Well, there's been a lot of attention on the vote that happened Tuesday to start debate on the repeal of Obamacare and then the failure of the vote to repeal and replace. And that's been most of the attention on social media today. Mm-hmm, but there's this other incident that happened on Capitol Hill that's getting a lot of attention.
Oh, yeah?
Happened between Senator Susan Collins of Maine and Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island. They were on a committee hearing, and they were talking at the end of this hearing, and they didn't realize that the microphone in front of them was on. And so they started to talk a little bit about President Trump and their dislike for them, which is particularly
Ooh.
Interesting because Susan Collins is a Republican, which is the same party as President Trump.
Wow.
And they go into a situation where they talk about a member of Congress who had challenged Senator Collins to a duel, and she said that he's a very unattractive member of Congress. So a lot of talk about these comments, people saying they're wildly inappropriate, shows
wow.
some of the divisions that are within Congress, within Washington.
Mm-hmm.
But other people noting that Collins is a Republican and Senator Jack Reed, who she was talking to, is a Democrat.
Huh.
And the fact that they're conversing like this and talking back and forth so freely shows that maybe there is some bipartisanship
Bipartisan smack talk.
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, when you have long days in the committee room, I guess party affiliation doesn't matter. Everybody has to vent at one point or another. Other people saying that Susan Collins was inappropriate to call her congressional male colleague unattractive. She's since issued an apology. But others people saying that they've picked up a new fan, that she's a new, they're going to be fans of hers, and she's a new favorite member of Congress because of these very frank comments that she made. So interesting stuff, and all generating from a hot mic. So be careful what you say in front of the mic. That's the lesson here.
All right. Thanks so much, Andrew. Good advice. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
VOA.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. For detailed information about your favorite sports, visit our website, voaafrica.com. And if you want to chat with me and sports fans in Africa and all over the world, visit my Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. There, the sports talk never stops. So So come on, join the action with the Sunny Side of Sports.
VOA's International Edition continues now as we turn to celebrity news. And today we're talking about how Britain's Prince Harry and Prince William are remembering their mother, Diana, Princess of Wales, on the 20th anniversary of her death. Joining me is Rare.us content editor Nicole Moschella. Nicole, the princes have spoken about their mother in a rare and personal way in this new documentary called Diana, Our Mother, Her Life and Legacy. And I understand that Harry talks about how he was 12 at the time of his mother's death and has regret about their last phone conversation.
So Prince Harry talked about this last phone call, and it was the day before or the day that she died. He was speaking to her because he was with his father on vacation, and he really rushed her off the phone. He was a little boy at the time. I think he was about 12 years old. And you know how kids are. They don't want to be on the phone all day. They want to be playing sports and whatever. So he wanted to get off the phone so badly. And now as an adult, as a grown man, he says in the documentary, if I had known this was the last time I was going to talk to her, the things I would have said. And so he really has that remorse of not saying, I love you, Mom, or whatever he may have said had he known that was the last time he was going to hear her voice.
Boy, that's just heartbreaking to even imagine someone has to go through life feeling that way, and yet what can you do? I know that Prince William also opens up about his feelings about his mother, particularly at his royal wedding to Catherine.
Yes, he said that he very much felt his mother's spirit as he was saying his vows and the whole engagement process when he was first engaged to Kate Middleton. She does wear Diana's ring. That is her engagement ring, so that's like a nice little heirloom. Plus, she's sometimes photographed wearing Diana's crown. And William keeps Princess Diana's spirit alive, definitely in his home, and especially with his two young children, Prince George and Princess Charlotte, who never knew their grandmother. Mm. Actually, William said that he thinks Diana would have been a very naughty grandmother, and she would have come over at bedtime and riled the kids all up and given them sweet treats, because she was very playful as a parent, as a mother, they both said in the documentary. And this is actually the first time, and the princes have both said the only time, they will talk about their mother like this. This is a documentary on demand. It's called Diana, Our Mother, Her Life and Legacy, and it's all about her and her relationship with her son.
And Prince William and Prince Harry, they didn't even see their mother for like a month before her tragic death. Is that correct?
Yes, that is right. The boys were on vacation with Prince Charles and had seen Diana earlier in the month and had been on vacation earlier in the summer and had been on vacation with her. And actually, sadly, they were supposed to be reunited with their mother the day that she died on August 31st, 1997, was the day they were supposed to go back home to her, and it ended in such a tragedy.
Very sad. Thank you so much, Rare.us content editor Nicole Moschella. We appreciate it. Well, singer Demi Lovato is releasing a new single. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London joins International Edition's Sarah Williams to tell us about the singer's often turbulent history.
Demi Lovato, who took the same path as many others through the Disney Channel, began on Barney and Friends, which wasn't a Disney show, but when she was 6 or 7, she was on alongside of her good friend Selena Gomez. Both of them came up through Barney and Friends, this mythical dinosaur figure for kids. And then eventually she landed a role on a Disney TV series called Sunny with a Chance. And then she went on to star in a film called Camp Rock. And she dated one of her co-stars, Joe Jonas, and it was a much publicized relationship. She's released a number of albums. In fact, she's had 9 multi-platinum singles and songs. And according to the latest statistics, she has achieved over $1 billion in streams with all of her music. And so she's back now with a brand new song from her next album. We don't know the title. We don't know the release date. This is the first song from the upcoming album. So let's check out Demi Lovato. And this is called Sorry, Not Sorry.
Not payback is bad chick. And baby, I'm the baddest. Stop playing with a savage. Can't have this, can't have this.
When you think of that term, sorry, I keep thinking of Justin Bieber.
He made that word quite famous, as a matter of fact. But he doesn't have exclusive rights to it.
Okay.
And so Demi's got a new album coming out, and the first song she's chosen is kind of a nice poppy, up-tempo song. She's known for that kind of music. It's called Sorry Not Sorry. We don't know the title of the album or its release date. Her last album in 2015 was an album called Confident, which kind of truly reflected a change for Demi. Demi has been a outspoken person on behalf of girl power and image and things like that. She's also, you know, talking about equal rights for women and gay rights. And so she's kind of using her fame in a very, very positive way. She's gone through a lot of things herself. She was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. She attempted suicide at one point. She was on tour with the Jonas Brothers, had to leave the tour and go into rehab. She was cutting herself.
Oh.
She had weight issues throughout her life. Well, she's turned things around now. She's approaching her 25th birthday coming up in a few weeks. And she's been working out once or twice a day. She's been dating a mixed martial arts fighter, learning mixed martial arts. She's got herself in great shape, and she's showing off her new body. She's always posting photos on Instagram. She has 153 million followers on Instagram. So we're all excited about the new album. By the way, she's also got her own cosmetic line, which is called Devon, and that happens to be her middle name. Her name is Demetria Devon Lovato. And so she's got her own cosmetics, and she's working on some other things, planning a tour, new album. Everything's going well for her. She even got her first Grammy nomination earlier this year. So it's been a great year, a great start to 2017 for Demi Lovato.
A very busy lady.
Very busy, probably going to get even busier now that the first song's out in a bit, and the song's called Sorry Not Sorry.
All right. Thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings. Baby, I'm sorry.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Russian Supreme Court recently upheld a ban against the Jehovah's Witnesses after the Russian Justice Ministry labeled the Jehovah's Witnesses an extremist group in April. It is the latest in a disturbing trend of persecution of religious minorities in Russia that includes the Church of Scientology. State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert urged Russian authorities to lift the ban on Jehovah's Witnesses' activities in Russia, to reverse the closing of the Jehovah's Witnesses' administrative center, and to release any members of religious minorities that continue to be unjustly detained for so-called extremist activities. We further urge Russia to respect the right of all to exercise the freedom of thought, conscience, religion, or belief, said Ms. Nauert. The Jehovah's Witnesses was organized in the 1880s in the United States. There are more than 8.3 million Jehovah's Witnesses worldwide, including about 175,000 in Russia. The U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, a federal committee responsible for making policy recommendations on international religious freedom to the President and Congress, also denounced the ban. The Supreme Court's decision sadly reflects the government's continued equating of peaceful religious freedom practice to extremism. The witnesses are not an extremist group and should be able to practice their faith openly and freely and without government repression, said Daniel Mark, chairman of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. This commission has designated Russia as a country of particular concern for systematic, ongoing, and egregious violations of religious freedom. All religious minorities in Russia should be able to enjoy freedom of religion and assembly without interference, as guaranteed by the Russian Constitution.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.